Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited. Subscribe to us through iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. United is back on the air tonight with a big, big episode. A lot of great geeky movie news to cover this week, including Ben Affleck being cast as the new Batman. We got some Star Wars news. We got a lot of movies to give our thoughts on. But let's get to our headline interview here at the top of the show. This is a director that we've had on three or four times before in the past, and he's always been very outgoing and helpful and conversational with us, and he has a very special way about describing the art of film directing in an easy to understand, applicable fashion. He uses that tone in his new book, which is titled John Badham on Directing. It's a really terrific guide to anyone interested in the art of film directing, the practicality of it, how you communicate with actors, how you communicate with the other members of the crew to get exactly what you want, how to establish a specific point of view as a director, just the ins and outs, A to Z of film directing. It's all in this book. Of course, Mr. Badham has directed such great classic films as Saturday Night Fever and War Games and Blue Thunder and Stakeout and The Hard Way, on and on and on. He's a great guy. We're always happy to talk to him. You can purchase his new book anywhere books are sold, including the homepage where this show is being hosted right now. You can click the title of the book, and it will take you on Amazon where you can buy it, or on our website at moviegeeksunited.net/merchandise. Here is Mr. Badham to tell us all about film directing and his new books. The first occasion of our conversation was your previous book, I'll Be in My Trailer, which was such a delight to read.
And thank you.
I'm wondering, what reaction did you receive from that book that led you to believe that, you know, there's another book in here?
Well, I think that just feedback I was getting from people, and then in my own observing how things that were working that I had talked about, I learned more things and said, oh, man, I should have put this in the book, and I should have put that, and how about this? but I think the main thing that got me started was thinking about how common it is that actors don't trust directors, and what is it the directors do that causes this mistrust, and how can they repair it? Because I didn't put the responsibility on actors, I put it on directors. That's their job, you know, to get the best performance from the actors, no matter what the situation. So a lot of investigating among actors and directors, trying to come up with some answers.
Well, you've been doing this for so long now. I mean, great film after great film. And so do you find that you're still surprised with the process, that you're still discovering?
Oh, God, yes. That's the great thing about it. It's always every day is a fun challenge. Some days maybe not so fun, but if it were just fitting a wheel to an axle, I would have given up on it a long time ago. But as my friend Richard Dreyfuss says, every scene, every shot is an interesting problem and a challenge to be solved, and solved creatively. So I'm always struggling to think, you know, how can I do this in the best way, and will this work, and what's a fresh way to do this, and what can I do that will stretch myself so I'm not just doing the same old, but maybe I can learn something from this director or that director.
So, this is something that I'm very curious about, because I read this section of the book very anxiously. When you're dealing with that first day on the set, films are very expensive. I'm sure that the budgets, especially these days, don't allow for a lot of rehearsal or minimal pre-production time. How do you establish that sense of trust and comfort when you have so little time to do so?
Well, of course, we've always had little time, and if you're, you know, remarkably clever, you're able to wheedle a little bit of rehearsal time out of your producers. But otherwise, you have to steal it and find opportunities to do it. And I do it, first of all, in casting sessions where I'm reading the actor, because that's a good time to kind of explore some of the possibilities of the script and say, well, I wonder if this would work, or let's try this. And actors at that point are willing to stand on their head naked, to try anything, because they're anxious to get the part, but they're in a very cooperative, fun mood. So you use rehearsal as casting as a rehearsal session, and a lot of times I'll say to an actor, you know, that's a wonderful idea. If you don't mind, I'd like to use it. You know, I'm not sure if you're exactly right for this part, but thank you so much, because you've really helped us today. Mm-hmm. It's sincere, and the actor goes out feeling, well, I didn't get the part, but, you know, I contributed something, and the feedback I get from those sessions is tremendous. And then I like to call actors up after we've cast them and say, you know, what are you thinking about? What concerns do you have? Worries? What would you like? Even in a couple of cases where I've just been able to leave a message on their voicemail, saying the same thing, and they'll come to me after and say, "Thank you so much for calling. I feel so much better coming to work. Nobody does this anymore." Just that, you know, feeling like somebody's taking care of you. And as you may have seen in the book, I liken it to the doctor or surgeon coming in to see you before an operation. And he may just drop in and say, "Hi, and you're doing okay, and well, we're going to get those tonsils out or do whatever we're going to do." And there's something comforting about that. Mm-hmm. And so much of working with actors is helping them find their comfort zone and helping them feel that they can try things and do things and not be yelled at, that they're in good hands with people who want to support them.
It makes them feel like a valued part of the process. Even something that seems as small as something that you write in the book that proves to be very important, just knowing their names and addressing them by their names on the first day.
Oh, makes a huge difference. I mean, I do that with the whole crew, and they may not even be aware of it, that I'm you know, learning them. And then I'm sneaking around a little bit during the shooting process going, oh, can you tell me what that guy's name is over there? I don't know. Or I'll just go right up and say, hi, I'm sorry, I just don't know your name. And then I make a real effort to retain it.
Yeah.
And again, this gets people, you know, willing to go that extra mile for you and try harder, and it keeps morale up. And they think that they believe that you care about them. Well, you do. You know, it actually helps. It's not a ploy. It's just a way of getting everybody to work together.
And the thing that I love that you say, I think you covered it in the previous book as well, and it's reinforced here, is the directors. There's certain things that directors can or actors can play, and they can play action. So when you give them a direction, make sure it's an action, it's a verb, it's something they actually can get their hands around.
Yeah. Directors not only talk too much and say things that, you know, go on for so long that the actor's eyes will glaze over, but they talk in terms of unactable things like, well, when you were a little kid, you know, your dad used to, you know, beat on you for wetting the bed. Well, yeah, okay, fine, that might have been true, but you can't act that. There's nothing you can do with that in the scene except mope around or something stupid. You need something you can do right now in the scene. And whether it's, say, punish this other person or seduce the other person or shrink inside yourself, withdraw from the scene, whatever the situation is, you need to give them something they can do right then. And, you know, directors talking about what happened in previous lives or mood or the theme of the movie, like, oh, this is about the cosmic theme of this and that and metaphysical bullshit, is no help at all.
Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of something that James Woods talks about in your book. And he echoes something very similar. And you've, of course, worked with James Woods in one of my favorite movies of yours, The Hard Way.
Thank you.
I love that movie. But when you're working on a film like The Hard Way, where it's a very energetic, very fun movie, I would think that dictates the tone that you set on the actual movie set.
Sure. You definitely get caught up in the tone of the movie, and if it's a deep, dark drama, you're not likely to be jumping around wearing a clown suit. you're going to kind of fit yourself. It's just natural. You just naturally fit into the mood of the film, and if it's something a little funny and giddy, of course, that's just delightful, or you're doing a musical, you know, those are delightful, wonderful things. But even if it's a serious drama, you find yourself maybe walking around a little more quietly and talking a little more quietly. And that's fun in its own way.
Mm-hmm. Do you give them an opportunity to... I'm sure you probably do this with every genre, but to play kind of beyond the actual scene?
I do. I really encourage the actors to follow their instincts, and if in the middle of the scene they feel an urge to do something, I say, well, just do it. It's okay. Just try it. The worst that can happen is next take we won't do it. But the worst that can happen is not that I'm going to think less of you. I'm going to think more of you for trying. And because it's in those instincts often lies gold. And when a scene is done at a point when I would normally call a cut, I might sit there for several seconds letting the digital media roll on. I can't say film anymore. Letting it roll on, and you get great moments as actors kind of let their guard down and they relax. The scene is over, and you see something that maybe they were afraid to let out during the scene, mm-hmm. or something that spontaneously just occurs. So I just looked at a cut of an episode of Nikita that I just did, and there are several of those moments with the star Maggie Q that happens like after the scene is over, but I let it run, and we would get these beautiful little nuggets of acting that she does.
Mm-hmm. I was just talking to I love that approach because I was just talking to Jerry Schatzberg and he was talking about directing Pacino and Hackman in the film Scarecrow, and he said that he would always not cut when the scene was over because he knew Hackman was going to do something surprising.
Yes,
that's just a beautiful process.
It is, and especially when you know the actor. You know the actor, and you get to learn them. You say, "Okay, let's wait and see what Gene is going to do." The great old character actor E.G. Marshall was like that, and I knew it because I had worked with him in summer stock at Williamstown, and knew that he would do that. So, and he caught on to the fact that I knew that he would do that, and so he would. Often it would be obscene and unprintable and hilariously funny, but you know, you just hang in there with him, and you were going to get a gift of some wonderful.
But here's the, I guess this is the major conflict for a director, particularly when you have to adhere to a budget and a schedule. You know, a main motivation is making the day. You always hear about making the day. Is that a major struggle between making your day but still allowing for those moments of discovery and exploration?
Well, yes. It's tricky, and it takes some experience to know when you can take advantage of the time you have and when you've got to just press on. But one of the things that always gets short-circuited especially in the television process is the acting talent. And yet the cameraman will take a certain amount of time to light, and the sound guy takes the time, and the grips are setting this up and that, and you know, makeup and hair, and next thing you, as Rod Steiger says, somebody snaps their fingers and says, "The magic, please," and you get no time for the creative thing that you're there to capture, and it's up to the director to try to maximize that time, and once you get a camera rolling. Thank God for one of the great advantages of digital media now is you can keep that sucker rolling for way longer than with film, and you can go back and do a scene two or three times and never cut, because the minute you cut, 20 people come running on the set, hair, makeup, costumes, grips, lights, you know, they're fiddling and messing with this and that, but if you keep it rolling, everybody sits quietly and behaves. And you say to the actors, they get to the end of a take, okay, that's all right, keep it rolling, go back, just start again, and you will watch those actors just reorganize themselves real quickly, and you do it again, and their concentration never fails, and you often use it to not only get additional things, fresh things, but to relax an actor who may be very nervous. And just having it quiet and doing it over and over again in the same situation is a very, very helpful way. Whereas when you cut, you know, suddenly it's all stressful again. Oh my God, they're putting the slate in. Oh my God, I better be good. Oh no. So there's that, those ways that you can take advantage of even the very limited time that you have.
Yeah. And tell me about your use of camera generally. I mean, I know that every film dictates its own sense of style, but more and more nowadays we see action films that are wall-to-wall cuts almost in a way that we can't tell what's going on. It's almost like they're covering something. But your action in every one of your films is so clean, and you understand the choreography, and everything's very clear for the audience. Tell me about your shooting style, I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, I guess it's coming out of just basic storytelling of, do we know where we are? Do we know who this person is in this cut? And you can generate artificial excitement by cutting fast at the expense of losing what the story is about. And we see, you know, movie trailers all the time that are cut every, almost less than every second. There's a cut. And it seems exciting, but if you ask somebody to tell you, you know, what do you think the story is about, they go, I don't know, it's a lot of bang bang. So my focus is so much on, is it clear where we are? I don't want to spend a lot of time. I don't need to lay on it and you know, make a big meal out of it. But have I given the audience a good clue where something is? And am I following what's going on between the characters? Because at the end of the day, if you're not sympathetic with the characters, you know, you've lost it all. You've just been on a big theme park ride that you kind of forget, you know, 2 minutes after you walk away from Magic Mountain or you know, Space Mountain, that's what I wanted to say, Space Mountain, or one of those big rides at Magic Mountain,
yeah.
where you get a lot of thrills, but it has no lasting effect.
Because you didn't have an experience where you related to characters, and you were experiencing the movie through their eyes. And which brings up another great part of your book that I read with great interest, which is establishing a point of view. Could you talk to me a little bit about directorial point of view, what that means to you and how you achieve it?
Well, there's directorial point of view, and then there is character point of view. And the first thing I'm looking for is character point of view. How does it, you know, whose point of view is this scene from? If it's the girl and the boy talking together in the park, is one more important than the other? Is it, are we seeing it from her eyes that she's, you know, she's looking at this guy in a good way, in a positive way? She's hoping that he will, you know, be the kind of guy she wants to be with. We don't want to just see it objectively. Like, well, there's two people in the park and they're sitting there, but, you know, whose point of view is this? So that's one thing that's always important when you go into a scene, as opposed to just seeing it like a documentary where you're sort of trying to objectively look at it. And then directorial point of view is probably, you know, what unconsciously or consciously I'm trying to do to say about the world or the scene that's going on. You know, even in dance sequences, like in Saturday Night Fever, there's a directorial point of view in the disco that's kind of different from the kind of documentary point of view out on the streets, mm-hmm. where we're looking at it a little bit objectively, but in the disco there's a whole magical the kind of thing in its own tatty way You know, you say this is a magical world. Well, that's something that's a directorial point of view. We could have made it all look tatty and horrible, but we chose to make this, you know, kind of rundown old disco look kind of magical because that's the way the kids saw it. So it was sort of directorial point of view imposed on a character point of view.
Yeah, yeah. I cannot thank you enough for these two books. And what I love about them, it's you read some books and they're all kind of theory and they're you can't really grasp them. And you write in such a conversational tone. And it's beautiful and inspiring, just like your work.
Well, thank you so much.
So thank you so much. I always enjoy talking to you, and let's do it again sometime. Thank you so much.
Okay, anytime. It's my pleasure to chat with you. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, that was John Badham. The book is titled John Badham on Directing. Buy it now. Okay, guys, big news this week that apparently has thrown the world into a tizzy.
It is
like,
bad.
Do you feel like the globe is off its axis somehow by this earth-shattering news?
Well, I think it's sad that of all the stuff that we've dealt with, some really big things like that should cause outrage, but this is the thing that does it. And I have to say...
Not chemical weapons in Syria. It's Ben Affleck
and
Batman.
No. Yeah. Ben Affleck, this is the thing that really gets everyone off their rocker. And I mean, I want to talk about this because I don't even think this is, of this particular story, this is not the worst news about this. I think there's something at the root of all this is even something more troubling. Because I don't think Ben Affleck is Batman. He is good or bad. It's just whatever. Kind of. It's like, okay, that's who you want. I don't have the same problems with people. One of my friends referred to him as a moron. And I'm like, if that guy's a moron, I wish I could direct three films that good.
We're not really talking about his directing ability here. We're talking about his acting ability.
I don't have a problem with that either.
I mean, let's face it. It wasn't his acting that made Argo great. If you thought Argo was great, if he's gotten better over the years, no question about it. But at the beginning, for me, he was kind of a meatball, and I kind of didn't really like.
But he knew that.
That doesn't matter.
Let me think. This is a guy who had enough sense about him, humility about him, and said, "Yeah, Jiggly's awful." But he was in good films before that, and he was in good films after that. I will admit that Some of All Fear is changing lanes. He admitted that his whole thing with J-Lo, this was a huge mistake on my part. I admire that. He has humility, but I don't think he's a moron. I don't even think he's a bad actor.
Well, I would never call him a moron. That's right.
No, that really got to me. But let's get to the bigger problem here. As soon as Warner Brothers said Batman will be in the next Superman film, you have to say, okay, so you have finally admitted that you guys don't know what to do with Superman. You have admitted that he is a boring character. You need to bring in another character. Let's even go into the bigger thing. Everyone, Nolan should never make another comic book film again. Because if you bring Nolan into this, you are doing what I call a Joe Gibbs. You want Joe Gibbs to come back and coach for the Redskins because you think that's the golden period of the Redskins, and he did it, and it didn't work.
You can't reheat a souffle. You can't get the Beatles together again,
even if
they were all alive.
Even if Christian Bale and Nolan came back to this, it would not work.
What would be the point of that?
you're already saying, first of all, I thought Batman would be on ice for at least 5 years. No, that's not going to happen. I thought we'd leave Batman alone. But I think this shows a desperation of Warner Brothers that you want to bring Batman back into this. I mean, it doesn't matter if you got Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I mean, he was smart. He knew, I'm not touching this with a 10-foot pole. And supposedly there's a rumor that they offered Christian Bale $50 million. Is there any validity in this?
For Justice League or something. But here's what I think. This is what's curious to me. what's curious to me is not Warner Brothers choosing Ben Affleck to play Batman, because that seems like, okay, it's as good a choice as any for me personally.
Yeah.
What's curious to me is why Ben Affleck would choose to do Batman at this stage of his career, because he's worked so hard at career rehabilitation. He knew he had become somewhat of a laughingstock, and he worked so hard to, starting with Hollywoodland and his performance in that film, all the way to winning Best Picture last year. So doesn't Batman feel like a step down from that?
Oh, big time. I mean, that's really, I thought it was like sort of like I had to check the calendar to see if it was April Fool's when I saw all this stuff.
Much less Zack Snyder's Batman. But here's what they said. Ben Affleck wanted to make sure that he was in on creating the character of Batman for the movie. So he and Zack Snyder are collaborating on building that character and making it unique. Batman in this movie is a much older, kind of worn down version of Batman. At the same time, I don't know the script, and neither do they. I think all they know at this point is the concept behind Batman. It could be a very well-drawn, dramatic character the way they play it.
Right. But I have a question for you, just from a screenwriting, just from a narrative perspective. At the end of Man of Steel, I think the first half of Man of Steel is wonderful. I think the second half is downright dull. I think it's actually rather boring. But Superman is not really established as a world, you know, he is still, rather, how shall we say it, a fugitive, a refugee almost character. He is not, we don't, in terms of this universe, this Superman, he is not a, you know, how should I say it, he's not, he wouldn't be anybody's equal yet. We don't have any, I don't get a feeling of who Superman is by the end of this movie. And Batman is going to be this, like, big, you know, a war, and, you know, I would imagine they're going to build on the events from the Nolan movies. I don't see how they can, but it just doesn't feel, as far as in a screenwriting, in a narrative, it doesn't feel right. It just doesn't, it feels very jarring.
Yeah, I mean, is there a movie big enough for the two of them? I don't know. But maybe by deepening Batman's character within that framework, they hope to do the same with Superman's character in relation to him. The exciting casting news about it, and I guess this is legitimate, is that Bryan Cranston will be playing Lex Luthor.
That will definitely. I think you need to bring Lex Luthor into this at some point, so... That will be, I agree, I think that's great. He is a perfect Lex Luthor.
And Affleck is wanting to, they are wanting Affleck to do multiple Batman movies or make multiple appearances as Batman. It's a beginning of a franchise with Affleck.
Right. You know, I have to say something here. Warner Brothers and DC have not had the best of luck here outside of the Batman movies. Marvel's had a tremendous amount of luck with what they're doing with the Avengers and how they tied all those characters and separate movies into that. I see Warner Brothers having a lot more difficulty here with this Justice League movie. I just don't know how they're going to do it. I think Man of Steel is troubling because it reminds me so much of the Thor movie from a couple of years ago, and I actually think that's a better movie. Man of Steel just, I mean, like, your review was the first thing that I had read about the movie, and it was like a real wake-up call. It's like, oh, wow, this may not be the promised land, and it wasn't. So I think they're all on shaky ground. I think Ben Affleck could help it. I think he should actually go ahead and, you know, maybe direct one of these movies.
Yeah, and speaking of directing, I mean, he's pushed off directing The Stand, for one thing. Stephen King's The Stand is now going to Scott Cooper, who did Crazy Heart and the new Out of the Furnace movie. So maybe we'll start seeing some motion on The Stand now. But, you know, so Affleck has gone from winning for Argo last year to working with Fincher now, because he stars in the new Fincher movie, playing Batman. And I don't know when he's going to direct next. I think even the movie that he was going to do based on another Dennis Lehane novel, that's been pushed aside too, I think.
Ah, that's a shame. I do think him taking Batman is kind of a step down
because it seems contrary to the trajectory he's been chasing allows him an opportunity to grow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that opportunity by playing Batman in a Zack Snyder movie.
No, I agree. I think it's especially if you're going to go from, especially if he's working with Fincher, which is right there in education, and for him is definitely an education in extending his directing craft. I do think this is a massive step backwards. And, you know, to go back to the thing, a lot of people, he may be a very good Batman. Everyone was so quick to trounce on Heath Ledger and Tobey Maguire.
Yes. And Michael
even
Keaton.
Even Robert Downey Jr. and Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
So I don't doubt, I think he would make a great Batman. It's just why? Why would you want to do this now?
Well, I mean, do you think they just picked him because, you know, he's perhaps the biggest star that's 40 years old now? I mean, is that really
just
me?
He has a solid relationship with Warner Brothers that they want to maintain.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think that has a lot to do with it. I mean, you know, as far as you know, whether it fits into the trajectory of his career or not, I mean, It does feel like, you know, he's already hit the whole superhero thing once and it didn't really work. So it does seem like, you know, you're going back to the trough in some ways, you know. And of course this will be a lot more successful than Daredevil, but
I don't know if Daredevil would have ever been successful with anyone, because it's just, I don't think it's a great movie. And if I hear one more person say, "Oh, you need to watch the director's cut," I really don't care. I like Daredevil as a comic book character, but I just thought the movie, and just to prove my point about the movie, is that the spinoff of Jennifer Gardner, Elektra, another great character, was just as memorable. You know, so,
first of all, could they have cast anyone in this that wouldn't have sent the world spinning off of its axis? I mean, probably not, except for, I mean, even if they had cast Christian Bale in it, the world would have spun off of its axis, because people would have gone, they're going to pay him $50 million, and then, you know, that would have been a big deal. And these days, any announcement about the Batman franchise in whatever form it is going to, like, cause everybody to, like, really crap their pants. And that just makes everybody nuts. Just like the making of Star Wars. Any announcement about any making of Star Wars or anything.
Well,
Those two franchises...
It's very good that you mentioned Star Wars. That's a great segue, because that's the next thing I wanted to discuss. The first news item being that the DP of the original Star Wars, Gilbert Taylor, passed away this past week.
Yeah, I know.
He shot tons of movies, including Doctor Strangelove, of course. But 99 years old. I read, like, they've been running quotes from past interviews he did, and I read that he said George Lucas was of absolutely no help in making Star Wars. He offered
I believe that now.
Yeah,
like, how much can we actually consider Star Wars to be actually the visual look of Star Wars to actually be the work of Gilbert Taylor rather than of George Lucas?
Yeah, but part of what makes Star Wars exciting, the first Star Wars and his work on it, is the fact that obviously, all movies were shot on film back then, but they are also shot using models and all of that practical stuff. Apparently, the next Star Wars movie that J.J. Abrams is doing, they announced it will be shot on film, 35mm film. It will not be shot in 3D.
Thank God.
Which doesn't mean the studio can't post-convert it, but
right,
maybe
true.
They will. But J.J. Abrams is against the use of 3D for Star Wars, they are expanding their model department. So I think they're going old school with Star Wars. I think they're making
all of that
huge
is good
models
news.
And stuff.
It is good news.
All that stuff is good news. Check, check, check. All that stuff's good news.
Well, now it all comes down to the story. It comes down to the story. I don't even care about casting so much. It just comes down to the story. And story-wise, the rumors that have popped up are troubling. But, I mean, you know, it's a good thing. We actually talked about bringing, I mentioned earlier about if Nolan came back to direct, you know, the Batman, another, this is upcoming Batman, Superman movie, or whatever the hell it's called.
you know, Lucas going back to direct Star Wars may be the ultimate textbook lesson that, no, you should not go back.
Don't do it. Don't do it. You can't go home again. You can't go home again.
Look, even Francis Coppola. Francis Coppola, as much as I love it, I do like the third Godfather movie, you can't, it doesn't matter who you are, you cannot recapture that magic. Even if Polanski came back and directed the two Jigs, it would not be able to recapture that.
Especially with the expanse of time that's fallen in between, you know, you know, if a large expanse of time has happened in between, you know, projects or whatever, it's harder.
It's very hard.
After that. Yeah.
Just can you imagine how much people will lose their shit once they announce that Ben Affleck is the new Luke Skywalker? I mean, that's going to be.
Oh, God. That's it. The world will erupt in flames. The world will just be destroyed.
Like, why doesn't Ben Affleck take every. Ben Affleck is the new Forrest Gump. Like, he could take every single beloved character. That would be great.
I have to go back and touch on something that I just had to make clear about this Ben Affleck thing. I think Ben Affleck has improved greatly over the years as an actor, but I don't think he's there to that point that Christian Bale was when he was cast as Batman. I don't think he's there at that point where, oh, God damn, Ben Affleck is going to be in it. I'm going to be there first day. That just doesn't happen. That's not going to happen.
And I think Christian Bale was even a great choice, but a risky choice because the movie before that was The Machinist, where he lost all that weight.
You know what made him the perfect choice for Batman at that particular time was that he had already made his mark with American Psycho. Even though that wasn't a huge hit at the box office, it was a huge hit on video, and it became a cult go-to movie. Everybody saw it.
Well, I mean, Christian Bale and Ben Affleck are two totally different kind of entities.
They have a different approach to the craft.
It's like the difference between a methody chameleon and a worker bee. And Christian Bale was, he was brilliant right out of the gate with Empire of the Sun.
Totally.
So he's been giving tour de force kind of work for a while now. Ben Affleck is a different kind of performer, you know.
He's just not as exciting an actor. Let's just face it.
You're right. He would probably be the first one to tell you that.
Well, you know, it's not that I don't like him. I like him a lot better than I used to. So, I mean, but you know, but at any rate, you know, I mean, for me, you know, Batman,
but is it worth
Superman.
All this craziness, though? I've never seen anything like this.
Like I said, they're going to go. That cabal is going to go crazy no matter what is announced.
Imagine if we had like the social media back when. I mean, Nicolas Cage was going to be Superman.
Yeah.
I mean, now in hindsight, that is a horrible idea.
Well, that would have been a much more interesting movie, though.
It would have been the heaven's gate of its day.
Cage as Batman. I mean, as Superman would have been something to see.
I think we're at a point now where all three of us have now seen Blue Jasmine. So I think
yes.
all three
okay,
of
cool.
us collectively
oh, awesome.
Can give our 2 cents to it.
Okay.
You know what? I went to see Blue Jasmine last night, and this... All of these like kids started flooding into it, and it made noise all the way through it and stuff. And I was like, "Really? A Woody Allen movie? It's like, is there no place where you're safe from noise and troublemakers at the movie theater?" Yeah. Anyway.
Were you able to enjoy it?
I was, yes, and I'll tell you, that movie grated my nerves for a while.
He can't help but do that. I mean,
I think the impossible task he set up for himself was to slowly chip away and find humanity in this lead character, and eventually for me it got there.
Okay.
That's interesting. Okay, that's a very interesting point.
You know when it happened? It happened when, I mean, this is the most kind of traumatic, highly frazzled performance I've seen in a while that Kate Blanchett gives in this movie.
Yeah.
But it happened when she got the call back from Skarsgård. And she's sitting on the bed in her sister's house and gets that phone call, and then she hangs up and she starts to weep. And, you know, she lived in a certain reality that she established for herself, which was really a fantasy that existed outside of the real world. And she was just – it was like it's like what we're talking about going back to the well and how you can't recreate your past. She was desperate in any way she knew how to reclaim that. If it meant marrying another rich man or whatever, that's what she would do. But that moment really spoke to me. And it didn't feel judgmental, but it felt fully aware of who that character was.
That's a good point.
And I really started to feel it at that point. I don't know. How did you feel about it, Dean?
Well, I had a real, I mean, I liked the movie, you know, quite a bit. I mean, like, one of his best in a little while. And one of the things I really liked about it was that, for me, it was the first movie of his that I can remember seeing where the lead character was just completely, for me, completely reprehensible. Like, and that's to say, okay, let's just remember that she's a character that really knows what's going on throughout the entire, I mean, throughout much of the, you know, in the flashbacks and everything to her days with Alec Baldwin, the Bernie Madoff character. She really does know that he's doing some bad things, and this becomes clear in a very key moment in the movie. She knows a lot more than she's let on, and for me, she never really. Although I had sympathy for her, she never really. I still remember what you said, Jerry, about her being like Blanche DuBois. And I thought that was only surfacey stuff, you know, just the situation that the character was in. But I thought I was expecting a movie that had a character that was easily sort of. I mean, I find Blanche DuBois like I can sympathize with her quite a bit. I thought that she was obviously damaged, but.
She's like a Girl Scout compared to the character. I mean, Blanche DuBois is like a Girl Scout compared to this one. But
exactly.
Let me ask you a question, though.
This character is really mean to almost everybody that she meets. I think that's her number one flaw.
Let me ask you guys both a question, though, because you bring up, you think that, Dean, you think she's more reprehensible than Martin Landau in Crimes and Misdemeanors and
Jonathan
Ross Myers in Match Point?
Deconstructing Harry.
Yeah, I do.
I wasn't
actually
thinking that. I was thinking more of the serious dramas, but that's a good one too, Jamie.
I actually thought of Crimes and Misdemeanors because here's another point that third act reveal, how this reflects Woody Allen's view of life. If you recall, in Crimes and Misdemeanors, Woody Allen's viewpoint about the world and life and how it all works and how it's meaningless. He basically showed that Martin Landau committed this murder. He sanctioned the murder of his mistress.
Right.
He was guilt-stricken. But in the end, you know, that guilt goes away and you find a way to deal with it and live with it. And, you know, the world doesn't change. In this one, no matter the motivation behind it, she actually did the right thing.
But for selfish reasons, though.
Yes, but and she has been nothing but punished by that decision.
Oh yeah,
it's cheating.
That's a good point.
That's true. That's an excellent point. You're correct.
That's a great point, Amy. That's a wonderful point.
You know what? I think my deal with her is just that if she had only been a kinder person, I would have had a lot more. I you know. She's so upset over the fact that her fantasy world has crumbled that she has absolutely no love for her sister at all. I mean, like, just she's just there out of desperation. She makes no effort to try and understand the people that are in her sister's orbit. She also doesn't display any kind of sense of. She has a vague sense that she wants to be a decorator, but what she really wants to decorate is her own home. She doesn't really want to go into other people's home and decorate.
That's a good point.
So she doesn't really have any kind of interest or anything. All this time, she's never built up any true interest. She never even considered the fact that what happens if this all ends. She was just completely unprepared for any role in the real world whatsoever.
Oh no, that great scene where Ender Dice Clay shows up in the third, you know.
She's not accustomed to interacting with the real world. I mean, she's completely an insulated character.
Totally.
And I love the fact that she's complicated like that and unapologetic in a way that Woody Allen isn't going to endear her to an audience. You have to settle your own conflicted feelings about her yourself. Mm. But
yeah,
within that, it is wonderful. But within that, I did find it, on her terms, I found the humanity of that character, and I found the struggle in that character that made her human.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with
that.
It's so easy. I mean, Jerry, you were right too about what you said. It is as strong a movie about class division as any, certainly in recent memory.
Mm-hmm.
But it's easy when you're portraying those two opposite, polar opposites,
right,
to veer off into caricature either way. And I think that at times it might have happened with the Blanchett character, but. For the most part, I thought it was very honest about those divisions. I really felt the awkwardness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of division. There's a lot of stuff that comes into play that keeps them from achieving any kind of intimate personal connection, those two sisters.
Right.
And you felt the awkwardness of it, and you felt
mm-hmm.
the not wanting to verbalize or being
overly judgmental. You can feel the tension in those rooms.
And you can feel the past that they had shared without them having to talk about the past very much. That was really interesting.
That's great direction and great acting and great screenwriting. As reprehensible as she is, when she's like talking to herself or when she's really just you watch her just falling apart, I do have a degree of empathy for her, and that's
she says
something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she is really, there are some scenes, and I also, a lot of people, especially I guess when Melinda came out, people gave Woody Allen a hard time that he's not connected to the real world. I don't think I've seen a narrative film, not documented, a narrative film that is more in tune what's going on in this country right now. She represents a class of people that knows nothing, like you said, about the real world, but knows nothing about computers, and nothing about working. Even.
Mm-hmm.
I really felt horrible for her when she's in the dentist office learning and trying to juggle all this stuff and failing miserably. I felt for her because I think we've all been in positions like that at some time in our life, at a much younger age, mind you. But that says something about her performance that I was able to have empathy really throughout the whole thing for her.
She really did that. Yeah, I mean, her performance is magnificent, and it's magnificent also because it's so grating at times. She doesn't
mm-hmm.
soften the edges on Jasmine, which
right.
is commendable.
That's absolutely true.
But you know what? You watch something. I mean, to give you an idea of what a great writer Woody Allen is, you can look at Blue Jasmine as a story of a woman that starts her life again at an older age and,
mm-hmm.
and the difficulties mm-hmm. and challenges of that. Which is also something that Larry Crown is about. So here is the divide in quality of writing. You know?
Oh, John, Larry Crown. You have to bring that up, Josh.
Big,
how to kill the mood.
Big divide there.
Yeah.
How to kill mood. Larry Crown.
I thought that Woody Allen, maybe the first time that I can remember, at least, I could maybe go back to something like Mighty Aphrodite or something like that, but I really liked how he portrayed the people, you know, like Andrew Dice Clay and Sally Hawkins, but also Matt Casella and Bobby Cannavale. And
oh, he was great. Bobby was wonderful.
They were all so, you know, I was afraid that the movie would make fun of those characters, and it kind of did, you know, like when you see Andrew Dice Clay come up to Blanchett and Baldwin's great apartment, New York apartment.
Oh yeah.
He's in his members only jacket.
Oh, I know.
Jacket. Think of having. I just thought, boy, that's a great little detail. Funny, but also not too mean and everything, and kind of real and everything. And Andrew Dice Clay, I have to say. Andrew Dice Clay, how great was he in the movie?
Yeah.
I mean,
he was just superb. 20 years ago, that comedian, that guy who I always thought, and I won't lie to you, I thought was just a flash in the pan, but you would have told me like 20 years ago, oh, Andrew Dice Clay would be in a Woody Allen movie and would be incredible, I would have laughed at you. But you're watching it, and you feel for him.
I think it's important that it happened now. I mean that it's an older, weathered Andrew Dice Clay doing this part, someone that that has known the ups and downs, and I think that you feel that with him when it comes to the character. The thing is immaculately cast from top to bottom.
It is.
And Michael Stolberg is good, and Louis C.K. is good, and they're just in little. You know, you can almost those are you know in another film those would have been throwaway performances, but they're both very good. I mean, there's so much to those characters.
And also, interestingly enough, isn't this only? I guess he did. I guess Woody Allen did. Did he do anything else? He did that in widescreen, but this is really one of his few widescreen movies. One of his few scope movies. So visually, that's something to applaud too. I personally like scope movies better than 185 movies because I think that's how we really see. So I was like, wow, this is just great. Just even though it wasn't overwhelmingly great, like Manhattan or something like that, like in a visual level, it was still great to see that frame shape, you know, with the Woody Allen film, and especially one as good as this one.
Our last guest for the evening is none other than director Rennie Harlan, a massively successful director, movies like Die Hard 2. We talked about Andrew Dice Clay earlier. He brought Andrew Dice Clay to the big screen in The Adventures of Fort Fairlane years ago. The Long Kiss Goodnight is a personal favorite of mine. His new movie is called Devil's Pass. It's a found footage horror film, and it's available now on DVD, Blu-ray, and on demand. Here is Rennie Harlan.
This is really, it's a true story that took place in 1959 in Russia, where nine hikers disappeared and were found dead. And to this day, nobody's been able to explain what happened to them. And modern science has tried its best. So when I read about this and saw a couple of documentaries years ago, I was very intrigued and wanted to figure out a way to make a movie about it. But making a movie that would take place in the 50s with Russian characters felt like a tough sell to an American audience. So then we figured out that doing this as a found footage film maybe would give us an angle where we can take it to the modern day and still rely on all the facts that took place a long time ago.
Absolutely, and I guess that would be the challenge in it for you because you've made so many different kinds of movies. So when you read a script like Devil's Pass and you look at it, was that the main challenge involved to kind of follow the found footage aspect of it?
Yes, and I took it as a kind of a filmmaking exercise and an interesting challenge. Obviously, there's been some great movies in this genre, like Cloverfield or Wreck, but then also some films that were not so good or were made very, very cheaply, and the audience kind of ends up feeling a little cheated, I think, at the end. And we just took this as a very serious challenge and said, how do we make a movie that feels absolutely real, but also has production values that are something that you would expect from a little bigger film, but it still sort of organically all works together so that you have this first-hand experience of a POV camera, but hopefully also get a little more thrills than you would normally expect.
Yeah, and that's another part of the movie that really impressed me, because we're so used to seeing these found footage movies that that rely so heavily on the jerky camera and that sort of technique. But your found footage movie actually looks cinematic, and that has to be a delicate balance to achieve.
Yes, and thank you for saying that very much. But the challenge was to make it look realistic and naturalistic, yet make it designed very carefully. So the best thing is if the audience feels that it's real, and of course it's nice if they feel it's like a cinematic experience at the same time, because every frame, every shot is meticulously planned. One might think that the actors are holding the camera themselves. They never touch the camera because it's a completely professional camera that weighs more than 20 pounds. They never touch the camera, but we are creating an illusion that the actors are shooting the footage themselves. And it's the best thing if it feels like there's an immediate kind of a reality to it, while everything is rehearsed and designed very carefully and every frame designed so that it would be a cinematic experience without seeming too well-designed.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that impressed me about it, about a lot of your movies, is I'm always fascinated by movies that establish a great sense of place, of environment. And I wanted to know from you, when it comes to using location and establishing environment, what kind of preparation and thinking goes into that?
Well, I'm a huge fan of shooting a location and really going to extreme places to capture the feeling of the story, and whether it's in the mountains or on the ocean, I really thrive on the challenge of that, and I think it unites the cast and crew being under those circumstances into working as a one kind of a well-oiled unit, dealing with the same problems, whether in this case it was sinking in 20 feet of snow or being actually in physical danger from avalanches or being in freezing temperatures in locations that are accessible only by snowmobile. I thrive on that, and I think it contributes to the movie. And I always do a lot of research, like, let's say in the case of Cliffhanger, which is very similar to this in ways, we went to Northern America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South America, Italian, Austrian, and French Alps before we settled on the Italian Alps, just to find a place that would really look right. And in this case, we searched the entire country of Russia for the right kind of mountains and environment that would guarantee us the snow and the desolate feeling and all that. So for me, the environment is a character in the story, and I want the audience to be transported there and really feel what the characters are going through.
I'm so glad that you said that, because I adore movies that where you can feel the experience of shooting them. You can feel them in the film themselves, like this one, like Cliffhanger, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Even like something like Apocalypse Now, you see how that was made. And that's present in the film,
yeah.
That struggle and that sense of adventure.
Yeah, somebody just asked me what's my favorite movie, and I said Apocalypse Now. And it's very much because of that, because you are taken on a journey into a world that you haven't seen before, and it feels like the crew and the cast are really there.
Yeah, yeah. So when you're when you're working on a film like Devil's Pass and you want to establish a feeling for the audience that they're really there amongst this group, do you spend a lot of time with your cast before shooting? Do they have time to become acquainted with each other and get comfortable with each other?
Yes, that's exactly what we did. We brought everybody to Russia well in advance, and we started in this little town of Kirovsk, which is northern Russia, town that is famous for its mining industry and for the prison, most northern prison gulag in Russia that is there. So the people who live there are either prisoners, relatives, or miners. So it's a very dark, interesting place that spends most of the year in complete darkness and then part of the summer in complete brightness. So it's a place of extremes. The nature is very, it's above the north, Arctic Circle. The nature is very sparse, and it's a harsh environment. And I brought the actors there well in advance. We did a lot of rehearsals together, and to spend a lot of time together, whether it meant, you know, getting drunk at the hotel bar and swapping stories, or going out and putting snowshoes on. You know, pretty much everybody was on snowshoes for the first time in their lives, and we just put the strapped the snowshoes on and went out into the wilderness and learned how to use them, and made a campfire in the middle of nowhere and sat in the snow and listened to the mind-blowing quietness of the mountains and nature. So it was definitely about bonding and building relationships so that everybody sort of really started behaving like you would behave. And there was a lot of improvisation involved also in the dialogue, because people got to know each other and really took into their characters and became those people.
You know, another thing that really interests me is directing films that frighten you, and producing scares as a filmmaker. How difficult is it to gauge on the set whether or not you're successful at reaching those beats, and how much of it can you manipulate and find in the editing room?
You know, with a normal horror film, you can do a lot in the editing room, because you can change the pace and you can change the order of shots and the rhythm and all those things. It's really hard in this genre, because basically you don't really edit much, and you have to sort of get it when you're on the set. So you spend a lot of time rehearsing, and you shoot in a very short time, because every scene is practically one take. And so it's a matter of figuring it out before, as you're developing the script, then in your shooting, how to create negative space, the space that somehow is threatening for the characters and feels oppressive, and whether to be wide or being tight, and what kind of lens it's going to be, and it's you know it when you hit it right on the nerve, like a dentist hitting the nerve in your tooth. You know it on the set when you hit it, and then there are situations where you, like, you're just praying and hoping that you are hitting it, but you can't know without you know, watching the whole movie later on. And also in found footage, what makes it harder also is that you don't have music, so you can take a fairly ordinary shot or a scenario in a normal movie, and with the music, you tell the audience whether to be nervous or whatever that emotion might be. But here you don't have that, so you just have the ambient noise and your actors in front of the camera. So it's definitely challenging, and a lot of planning goes into it. And then, you know, when it works, and sometimes there's nothing you can do when it doesn't.
Is it? I'm sure that you've screened this for audiences, or you've been present at screenings of this for audiences. This kind of movie has to be just absolute fun to witness with an audience.
It really is, and the tricky thing is when making a movie in this genre and showing it to an audience is to figure out what exactly they are saying in the responses, because first thing that happens is that people say, oh, the beginning of the movie is a little slow. And that they're saying it because you can't, in this genre, you can't have just scary stuff start happening immediately. You have to take time to develop the characters, create the reality, and then put those characters that you've learned to know and hopefully like, then start turning the screws and putting them into a threatening situation. But the audience, of course, the funnest part is when stuff starts happening and it gets really scary and fast-paced and exciting. But when the audience tells you, like, the beginning feels slow, does that really mean that it's slow and it makes the movie less good? Or are they just saying it because they had fun in the end and they were thinking, like, oh, it would have been fun if we got to that exciting part sooner? Because if you take the character development and the sort of the mood development away, you might take away what makes the latter part of the movie exciting. So the testing period is definitely helpful, but it's tricky because you have to be kind of a mind reader instead of just taking directly the comments as they are presented.
Yeah, I understand. But working in this genre, I mean, it must be so great for a filmmaker to work in this genre because it really gives you an opportunity to play an audience like a violin.
Yes, horror genre in general is so fun for a director because you do get to play the audience like the violin, and when it works and the violin plays beautifully, it is incredible because you are the puppeteer, and that's why people go to the movies. They go there to scream or laugh or cry, and you know if you can scare them and make them jump. I just had some young relatives visiting me, and they wanted to see one of my movies, and I showed one of my movies to them, and something that I just didn't think was a big deal at all. They almost spilled their drinks and fell off the sofa when they were watching the scene. And then later on, they were laughing about how scared they were. And it was just great to see. So it's definitely a very, very satisfying genre. It's like I compare it to, like, as you know, getting as close to being a rock star as a director could ever be, because it's your stage and your audience is there, and you can make them, you know, do almost anything if you hit it right. So the answer is yes, it's super, super fun.
You know, there's a lot of changes happening in filmmaking or that have already happened with digital technology, and now we have video on demand taking more of an impact in the industry. What do you think about the direction that movie making is going? Are you excited about it? Or are you skeptical about the loss of film? Or how do you feel about it?
Movie making, of course, has changed a lot. We all know that the studios rely now on tentpole movies and franchises that can support amusement park and books and videos and comic books and all this stuff. And it's a pity that there is less and less versatility. There's the, you know, the odd movie now and then that comes as a surprise, and people go like, oh, why don't the studios make movies like that? And for the moment, the studios consider it, but they really go back to their old ways, and they really don't pursue those avenues. And we have to remember that for every one of those movies that comes out as a surprise, there's probably 100 movies like that that we've never heard of. And that's the sad thing. Nowadays, for movies to get distribution, because the DVD is dead, that changed so much, because with smaller movies, studios could rely on, like, okay, even if it's not a big theatrical hit, we still make lots of money from DVD. That's all changing now, and of course there's video on demand and internet distribution and all these things. Bottom line is the new generation watches movies when they want and where they want. I still believe that people want to go to the movie theater because the collective experience is so fun and exciting. And the bottom line is that if Hollywood makes good movies, people will go and see them. And anytime, you know, the horror film flops, or a comedy flops, or an action movie flops, Hollywood is quick to say, oh, that shows that horror doesn't sell anymore, or that shows that people don't want to watch action movies anymore. That's horse crap. The fact is, people will go to the movies if the movie is good, if they mm-hmm. and they sense it very quickly. If it's something that interests them, and if it's a good movie, they'll go and see it and they'll find it. So I would say that it's unfortunate that Hollywood makes less and less movies, and that they are so formulaic. I wish that there was more versatility, and I hope that that will happen with all these new distribution models, that there will be genres and subgenres that can flourish and show people that it's not as simple as you think, and you know, hope that the movie executives won't be so scared to let people with something to say and some personality to share to make films instead of just doing cookie cutter movies.
Okay, that was Rennie Harlan. Thank you so much to him for returning to our show to talk about his career and about Devil's Pass and his great work. Devil's Pass is available now on demand and on a variety of online platforms.
How does it feel to be the poster girl for the sexual revolution?
To me, it's a movie, like any other movie, only it has so many better things in it.
Like what?
Like me.
I like to meet your folks.
No, they don't think anybody.
I think they dig me.
Amen.
Amen.
Amen. I can tell you're such a good girl.
Does she even know what she's auditioning for?
She's adorable, but we traffic in fantasy here. You know, more pizzazz.
I want to show you this movie we made.
Oh, are you actually doing that?
Action.
We're all going to win Oscars.
The pornographic film Deep Throat has become one of the most popular movies of all time.
Hi, Mr. Hefner.
Hefner, please.
Your girl's going to be a star.
What about me?
I didn't know who that was up there. It's certainly not my little girl.
I got the coat, Daddy.
What is going on? It's Chuck's
neck. It's a long way.
I'm not doing any more porn.
We're gonna make it.
Ever.
I saw Lovelace, too. Did you like Lovelace?
Your review was dead on. What you said about Lovelace was, I thought, dead on.
All right. Well, then there's no need to talk about it.
Can I say something about Lovelace, though?
Stop it. Everything that I said was perfect. That's all we need to say.
Jamie DeMille is perfect. That's just everything Jamie comes out to. No, I want to say something, though, because I now really would have loved to have seen Inferno by Matthew Wilder with Malene Ackerman or even Lindsay Lohan. But I have to say, after watching this, I have to say, this is not the interesting story here. The documentary about Deep Throat was wonderful, but this is not really the interesting story. I actually think the interesting story here comes later with Marilyn Chambers and the Mitchell Brothers. The Mitchell Brothers, and I know that was made into a movie with Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez on Showtime long ago. But there is a great movie waiting to be made about the Mitchell Brothers. But having said that,
I totally agree with that. I think there's a much better movie waiting to be made about them too. I think that's where the since with me, like I haven't even watched Lovelace yet because I don't really know if that's really the most interesting story to tell out of all of this thing. I think it's the Mitchell Brothers that really deserves like
but
a real.
Paul Thomas Anderson fictionalized this period in time, well, I guess really the late 70s, that's still I don't care what anyone says, I think that's the best narrative film that's been made on this topic, regardless.
It's the gold standard. It's the gold standard that Boogie Nights is. I mean, even though I think it's a flawed movie, I still think it's probably going to remain the gold standard for a long time.
You know what? Lovelace did have the way it was shot, it did have a special look where it really looked like it was shot in the 1970s.
No, that's a good. I'll give you that. I'll definitely give you
It had that porn grain. You could coin that original
porn
quote.
Grain.
Yeah, it had the porn grain.
You know what I love about the movie?
That should be
cheaper,
like a new term
in the theater.
That should be a new movie term now. Porn grain. It's all one word. You know.
I saw it cheaper in the theater than I would have if I had seen it on demand. That's all I'm going to say about the movie. I did see it and watch it cheaper in the theater than even on demand. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
And I'm
going to
feel like waste
the
money.
I'm going to make an alcohol that's called porn grain alcohol. It's going to be...
Where can I get it?
It's going to taste really dirty.
I can only imagine what some of the secret ingredients are going to be.
I finally
saw Place Beyond the Pines, and so let me just throw in my two second contribution to that conversation. I like the ambition of it. You know, I like the epic drama that interconnects generations, and I like the ambition of that idea. But man, that movie for me was diminishing returns. Each act was a diminishing return for me. I was never as invested in that movie as I was during Ryan Gosling's section. And Ryan Gosling is such a unique presence. He maintains this aura of mystery about him, which is maybe genuine, maybe not. But I think he's really good. I think he's just scratched the surface. You know, you're always interested in seeing more of him. But I will also say that he suffers from DiCaprio syndrome in that when he screams, he sounds like a little girl.
I'm not going to say that in front of him, though, but yeah. I like the movie. I won't lie to you. I like the movie because I think it was the first good movie besides Side Effects that I saw this year. So I won't lie to you. I do enjoy it.
It, for me, of course, you know, it died in the third act. I like the first two acts. The third act was like,
You think that's overkill?
I think we could have easily seen that happening without us having to show it. They could have maybe hammered the whole thing home with just having those two kids meet and then have nothing else happen. And then you would have had a 20-minute shorter movie. You know, that whole third act was like, okay, what am I doing still here watching this movie?
Right,
I understand that.
That's a valid point.
But the way that Jamie puts it, diminishing degrees, that's pretty much right.
But also I saw a great documentary called The Crash Reel.
I love that.
Oh, my God. I don't know jack shit about snowboarding. about a professional snowboarder that went up for the Olympics and he had an accident. He massive brain injury and his rehabilitation from that. But what it really illustrates is, first of all, the nature of the competitive spirit, which is really supported by a beautiful family that this man has. And just like we were talking about Blue Jasmine, readjusting your priorities in life, you know, redefining who you want to be. Yeah.
Yeah. Like what happens when what you thought you were, who you thought you were ceases to be, and how you go back to find another focus in life. This is an HBO documentary, and HBO docs, I'm telling you, they just will not quit.
For God,
they are. Every single documentary you see from HBO, you just might as well say, well, I got to watch it because I know it's going to be great.
HBO.
They interview another professional sports snowboarder in the movie. Her name is Sarah Burke. So they interview her all the way through the movie. And anyone that knows the sport, I'm sure, knows that Sarah Burke, last year, a year before last, got into a tragic accident very similar, where she suffered a brain injury and she died from her injuries. And I mean, oh my God, what a beautiful, gorgeous girl this was. And she's interviewed all the way through the movie. And
I mean, they spent a long time on this movie too. I mean, what's interesting about these HBO docs is that when you're watching them, you're like, my God, they spent like 4 years. I mean, in this movie and in the last one that I watched, the Chelsea murders or whatever it was, they spent 4 years following these people. I mean,
The filmmakers did. Yeah. I think HBO just acquired the documentary at a festival. They normally do that, but.
They have really great taste, and
they do.
I'll tell you, this movie really. I mean, first of all, you know, it's interesting on that level of just of the snowboarding because I really don't know a lot about it, and it is amazing. But what these guys do, but it also calls into question the moral implications of actually driving snowboarders and so forth to actually one up themselves, you know, to their own peril. You know, it's like okay, now what are we really doing to these people now? I mean, now we really have to question. Yes, you're right. In watching it, you have to consider what we're doing to all, what our fandom is doing to all of these people who are throwing their efforts into this these sports, whatever they are.
Yeah.
I mean, this movie, you know, what was great about The Crash Reel was that it wasn't necessarily about what it looked like it was about at first. It was about 10 subjects, you know, swirling around each other.
Yeah.
And it was like, by the end of it, you're like, wow, this is an impossibly huge movie, and they did it absolutely correctly.
Well, yeah, that's what's beautiful about the documentary form, because the movie, especially when you devote that much time to it, the years that he followed this family around. Lucy Walker is the name of the director. She won an Oscar for, I think, the Cherry and the Blossom or something. I think it was a short film. She followed this family around, and I'm sure her movie was redefining itself over the course of years. She had no idea if her lead subject, Kevin, I think his name is, if he would survive or recover or what shape he'd be in if he did. You know, she didn't know what her movie would be.
That underlines my number one requirement for a documentary, which is, when you go in to make the documentary, you must be sure that you don't know everything about it. About the subject, you must be open. You must be open to the subject actually changing on you, and the most important thing about a documentary is that the viewer needs to be aware of the filmmaker's engagement in the story to find out exactly what really happens, you know, because if you don't have that, if you feel like the filmmaker knows everything about the subject from top to bottom, and that's what you get when you're sitting your ass down in the seat, then you get sort of a, that was a nice thing or whatever, but it wasn't something that just blew me away.
Jerry, tell me in these few minutes that we have left. You said you saw something good last night?
I did. I saw something. I mean, I've seen a couple of things since the last show, but I saw on demand Ain't Them Body Saints. And I really liked it. It's a very, I mean, it's really, you know, total Terrence Malick territory and everything, but I really enjoyed it. No one else I saw with liked it at all, but I actually enjoyed it. Thank God we didn't watch Prince Avalanche, although I really want to see that too. But I mean, I would have probably been crucified for that one.
Yeah,
but,
neither one of those are Saturday night flicks. You know,
But I liked it. I thought it was really well done. And I really, of all the movies that opened this weekend, that was the one I was really the most eager to watch.
Speaking of weekend flicks, I mean, Your Next is like a perfect Saturday night movie for most people. Does that work?
I thought Your Next was, you know, it's really interesting. Who would ever thought that two of my favorite movies of the year, you know, at least for the summer, would be two horror movies, The Conjuring and Your Next.
Yeah.
And Your Next is, and some of it I could, you know, there, you know, the reveals are, okay, I was thinking that, but not quite in the context of how they're played out. Your Next, at least in the trailer, totally flips the rules and everything from what I was thinking. I was like, wow, all right, that's okay. I'm in. I'm game. This is actually really much better than I, you know, was thinking. And when I walked in, I was thinking, you know, this is going to be really good, but it flipped my expectations big time. I thought it was really, for what it is, well done.
Good, good.
I mean, really, I mean, it's not what you think. It's not, because, I mean, it's the first night, even the first trailer I saw for it was in front of The Purge, and it was just like, no, this isn't anything like that. Okay.
You know
good.
What, though? I understand that they use a particular pop song from the 70s or something in the first scene, and it's very memorable how they use it. But is this like a... is this like a mandate now for horror movies? You have to find a pop song that you can make sound creepy. You know, like Insidious, Tiptoe Through the Tulips, or Zodiac, Hurly Burly Man, or whatever that song is.
Wait, that's a great point. There's a book waiting to be written about
this is a 60s pop song, but there's a song called Turn Around, Look at Me. It's all awesome. That would be great for a horror movie.
Totally.
It's amazing.
I always liked how this is nothing new, because I always liked how in that forgettable movie in the 80s, April Fool's Day, that horror movie, how they used that song. How they used that song, Mama Told Me Not to Come, which I always thought was so like creepy in a way, that song. And I said, that's perfect for a horror movie. And also, I would suggest Soundgarden's Black Hole Sun.
I love that song. Well, yeah. In 10 years, it should be definitely used for a horror movie.
Yeah. Well, just go and look on, if you, this, out of all the songs we mentioned, this is the one that you probably never heard, but Turn Around, Look at Me, I'm sure is on YouTube. Go and take a listen to it. And tell me if that's not perfect for a horror film.
I can't wait
perfect.
Until James Wan uses Can't Smile Without You from Barry Manilow in his next horror movie.
That's great.
That's gonna be something else when they use Barry Manilow.
Every time the possessed doll kills someone, you hear Can't Smile Without You, and it's anyway.
Wow.
Man.
Great shows upcoming next Sunday. We have Harry Dean Stanton, who is the subject of a new movie about his life and work. Harry Dean Stanton, Partly Fiction is the name of it. We'll have him and his director on the show. And, of course, following that, starting September 2nd, a two-week series, Art of Cinematography, the third season, close to 20 interviews with top DPs, including one I got to talk to in 4 minutes. Bruno Delbonnel is his name. I got to call him
good.
At his hotel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, dude. And then yesterday I talked to the guy. He was, Bruno is in San Francisco. He scouted locations for Tim Burton's Big Eyes movie today.
Dang.
And then yesterday I called, Darius Walsky, who is in the UK, and he's pre-production on Ridley Scott's new movie, Exodus.
Mm.
So these are big people.
Dude, this is enormous. This is
totally unbelievable.
Wow.
What can you say?
So anything else in these last 4 minutes? What should our mystery movie song be?
Well, none of the songs we talked about.
Okay. What's the name of that song? I'll play that song, Dean.
Oh, it's called Turn Around, Look at Me.
Let's do it. That's why not.
Turn Around, Look at Me.
Yes.
I can't tell you how many times I've said that to my date. Hang on. turn around and look. Oh, it's by the Vogues.
Yes.
Vogues. Turn around and look at me.
Vogues. For sure.
What woman has not said that phrase during anal?
Look at me.